Coming up on Tech News Weekly, did you hear? Facebook is a media company now. We can put that to rest. Also, the right to repair electronics is picking up steam. Therapy sessions can now be found online. We'll talk about that and the potential impact of the GDPR in Latin America. All that and more on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 35, recorded Thursday, June 7th, 2018. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again with Eero's hyper-fast, super-simple Wi-Fi system. And now, the second-generation Eero is tri-band and twice as fast. For free overnight shipping to the U.S. or Canada, visit Eero.com, select overnight shipping at checkout, and enter code TNW.
And by LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. Drive brand awareness, generate leads, and build long-term, purposeful relationships with LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. To redeem a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit, visit linkedin.com/TNW. Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is a show where we talk to the people making and breaking and analyzing this week's tech news. I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. And like we do seemingly every episode, we're going to start with Facebook. Mm-hmm. One of these days, we're going to have a show where Facebook isn't making news. I don't know when that's going to be. Facebook has had to eat a whole lot of crow this year so far. But if there's one thing that hasn't changed, even through all of the Russian ads, the Cambridge Analyticas, the EU testimony, is that Facebook stands by its assertion that it is not, in fact, a media company. It is a tech company. Matthew Ingram wrote a piece for Columbia Journalism Review stating that it can no longer make that claim with its introduction of a new feature this week. And he joins us now. Welcome to the show, Matthew.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Just for video listeners, we do have Matthew on audio. Audio listeners, you're not going to know the difference, but let's dive in. Let's start with Facebook's assertion before we kind of get into the new feature itself. This has come up time and time again in the past, shot down by the company every single time, it seems like. What's at stake for Facebook if it had to actually admit that it was a media company? Why is it so steadfast in denying this?
So I think there's a couple of things at stake. One is Facebook wants to deal with media companies and wants to partner with media companies. Obviously, that's part of what this new feature is. And so it's hard to partner with people when you're in the same business as them. So I think in part, it doesn't want to admit that it's effectively the same type of media entity, because then it makes it seem much more like a competitor than it does a sort of partner. But I think there's a second thing that Facebook would like to avoid, and that is there are expectations sort of placed on media companies that they adhere to certain standards, or that they, you know, that they look at the world in a certain way, they approach the media in a certain way. We think of sort of quality news companies or media companies as having certain characteristics, and I think Facebook would just much rather be a tech company, because tech companies can apparently get away with anything.
Yeah, it seems that way. Although times are changing right now, so maybe not for much longer.
Maybe anymore.
Yeah. So obviously Facebook launched this new feature. It's called Watch. Every time I saw Facebook Watch, I was thinking, what, they're coming out with a watch now? The phone didn't even work. But anyways, something different. Tell us a little bit about this feature, the content, the partners. What is this all about?
So Watch is Facebook's basically long-form video, a place to watch long-form video. So if you remember, Facebook Live was their sort of shorter-form video. They wanted everybody to upload little clips of this and that, and a lot of media companies dove in headfirst into that idea. Watch is much more longer-form and sort of TV-style content, so they're partnering with specific organizations. I think 140, the Wall Street Journal said, some of the usual names, New York Times and so on, BuzzFeed. Actually, I don't think the New York Times and BuzzFeed are involved, but there's sort of classic names, CNN. Actually, New York Times is involved, sorry. Huffington Post, and also some, I guess, celebrities who you would think of are kind of their own media entities. And they they specifically want these organizations to create TV style content. So for example, CNN's going to effectively just create shows shorter than say a normal long run TV show that are going to be that you will watch through this special dedicated Facebook tab.
So some of the people they chose, ABC, CNN, Fox News, Univision. So you get those lists and you think, oh, well, that's a wide variety of different opinions. But what are some of the consequences of the fact that they're just picking, you know, cherry picking these sources? Like it's them picking it. Like you said, this makes them a media company. They're making these big decisions. What are some of the consequences that you can see in the future of having them pick no matter who they're picking?
So I think the biggest risk is that they're effectively preferring certain entities over others. So they're picking winners in a way. They're saying these are the organizations that we think are, you know, high quality news organizations. We're going to work exclusively with them. And obviously that's, you know, we may agree that CNN is a high quality news organization. Some people might agree that ABC is or Fox News is, but the question is whether Facebook should be the one deciding what a high quality news organization is, whether Facebook should effectively be putting the power of that platform and its algorithm behind certain specific news entities. Because the risk is that if you're not part of this partnership, if you're not part of Watch, then, you know, you might as well forget about doing video on Facebook, because presumably the algorithm is going to favor the partners that they're working with.
You point out in your article the risks that Facebook could someday do what it's already done in the past, which is decide to totally change course, and that in turn might leave, you know, publishers out, you know, out to dry, essentially. I mean, they've had efforts in the past, you know, with ads and content where people come in and they devote themselves to this new way of doing it on the Facebook platform. And then Facebook over time decides they're not doing that anymore. And there, I mean, there are businesses that are completely tied to that, that no longer have a business because of that choice. So they have a history of this. Why would outlets be crazy enough to do this again? Is there enough benefit here for them to be like, oh yeah, this time it'll work?
Well, that's a great question, because, you know, we've been down this road multiple times. I mean, Facebook Live was a big deal. They paid a bunch of media organizations in the same way they are now to create content. So then a bunch of organizations, you know, spun up large video teams so that they could create short form video that Facebook, you know, would appeal to Facebook and would presumably be favored by the algorithm. And lots of companies spent tons of money doing that. And then Facebook changed its mind and decided it wanted to focus on longer form. It was hard to monetize or even impossible to monetize. So lots of companies gave up. I think there's just a, you know, the short answer to your question is some of these companies are fairly desperate for new revenue. I mean, print advertising is declining. Subscriptions are working for some companies like the New York Times, but not for others. There's just a massive kind of revenue hole. And so if you're looking for revenue, Facebook has lots of money. And if they're going to pay you money to produce content, then I think some companies would think, well, great, we'll take some of Facebook's money and, you know, hope for the best.
Yeah.
So Facebook Watch is only available in the United States, and so there are only U.S. Providers of this content. The Facebook news, fake news problem is global. And, you know, they say, oh, we're doing this to combat the fake news problem. But, I mean, and arguably it's worse in a lot of other countries. So are they doing anything for anything globally? Like, are they talking about rolling this out globally, or is that just really too difficult for Facebook to choose global news sources to pick and choose like they've chosen in the U.S.?
I think they would probably, I don't know this, but I think they would probably like to roll it out globally. If it works, I think they would like to roll it out globally. But as you pointed out, the hard part is picking, you know, it may be easy for us to say, oh, the New York Times is high quality and this and CNN is high quality, but it's harder to do that in countries that you're not as familiar with, or where, you know, some of the media sources may not, you may not even be able to find one that is sort of similar to the New York Times or CNN. So I think that would be a harder assignment for them to do that in a whole bunch of different countries. But I mean, Facebook's a global platform. They do have global ambitions for almost everything. So I wouldn't be surprised to see them try and roll it out.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes sense that they would want to open that up down the line. I'm sure we'll hear more about that. And it'll be interesting to hear if Facebook ever has to finally say, okay, fine, we're a media company now. You got us. I doubt we'll ever hear them say that. Matthew Ingram writes for the Columbia Journalism Review, and actually you're on the network quite a bit. So we really appreciate you taking the time to join us here on Tech News Weekly. Thank you, Matthew. Always love getting you on.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right. You bet. We'll talk to you soon. CJR.org if you want to read Matthew's piece there. Take care, Matthew.
So according to the New York Times, China has stopped recycling foreign garbage. In their op-ed section this week, the director of the Repair Association wrote, "One of the keys that we know can reduce waste is by repairing and reusing things instead of assuming that recycling will solve our problems." Joining us to talk about his fight for the right to repair is Kyle Weens, founder of iFixit. Welcome back to the show, Kyle.
Hey, Megan, thanks for having me on.
So this week in the iFixit blog, you wrote about CalRecycle. That's the organization that oversees the nation's largest electronics recycling program. What can you tell us about the work of CalRecycle and how effective it is?
Yeah, CalRecycle is part of the California EPA, so it's our government program for paying for recycling of e-waste. You have things like CRT televisions, the old big TVs that have a lot of lead in them. It's expensive to recycle that, so CalRecycle runs a funding program to manage that. And what CalRecycle has been trying to figure out is where is the world of recycling electronics going to go over the next 10, 15 years as Internet of Things is putting electronics into things that didn't used to be covered under electronics recycling. So your smart toaster that can tweet at you when your bagel is done, that's got a chip in it now, and that needs to go to an electronics recycler instead of a traditional recycler.
So they came out with a report, and what was important about the most recent report they came out with?
The report's really interesting because it's a shift. It's a major shift in how we approach recycling. You think of CalRecycling, you think they're focused on recycling. Well, one of their major priorities for the next decade is they want to provide incentives for repair and reuse of electronic devices to prevent recycling. Mm. So this is kind of a fascinating, like, major shift where they're saying, hey, we want to actually move up the waste pyramid, move up the hierarchy, and if we can repair and reuse things, we'll actually be able to delay recycling it quite a while.
When I think of repair and in particular reuse, I think the word that comes to mind is standardization, right? Like this idea that and in technology, I mean, there is some standardization, but really, you know, technology companies love to have their secret sauce that no one else has, which makes reuse or repairing with parts that are easily accessible a really difficult thing to do. Is there any indication that any of this might involve like some sort of standardization of how these things would be built? I feel like maybe that goes outside of the purview of what this would be, but does that come into play at all?
They talked about a lot of the challenges around batteries. There isn't any recommendations in here for requiring manufacturers change their designs, but what they do recommend is right to repair legislation, which doesn't make any design changes necessary, but it does encourage manufacturers to share repair manuals, to make parts available to recyclers and refurbishers. So that would be one level of standardization of making sure if you're going to sell a product that there's information and parts available for fixing it. I think that would go a long way.
Sure.
So what about the dangerous chemicals that are involved in these products? Like, should we be worried about, like, our opening up our iPhone or whatever? What do we need to be cautious of when we dig in and repair all these devices that are made with who knows what at this point?
Your iPhone will kill you.
Well, I think it will, but...
It's not a problem when you're using it, but it is a problem if you landfill them. So if you look on the label of any electronic device, there's a little trash can with a line through it. You can't put the stuff in the landfill because the heavy metals, even things like silver and gold that are in your electronics can leach out into the water table and cause pollution. So it's important that these things not get landfilled, which as we have electronics and more kinds of things, it is becoming more and more of an issue. It's also important that electronics not go to your standard blue bin recycler. So I have – this is an Apple Pencil. It has a very big battery. Almost the entire inside of it contains a battery. If you throw this in the blue bin, it could very easily cause a fire at your municipal recycling facility because they're not set up to handle this kind of thing. This has to go to, specifically to an electronics recycler.
Interesting. And I wonder how much people are actually, kind of negotiating that with themselves when it comes to recycling, electronics recycling. It's not the easiest thing in the world. There are some things that you can put into the blue bins, depending, right? Like the things that don't have screens, or is there anything that you could even fit into a blue bin?
You pretty much never want to put electronics in a blue bin.
All right, that's good to know.
But you can take it to Best Buy. Best Buy will take them for free.
Yeah.
And other there's Recycle 911 is a great website which lets you look up local recyclers.
Right.
But pretty much Best Buy is your like guaranteed bet where you can take just about anything. They might charge you for larger TVs, but smaller stuff they generally recycle for free.
Yeah, and I've taken stuff to I think Office Max here in town will take it. Yeah. You can recycle for
Goodwill
free.
Goodwill is also really good.
Yeah.
Goodwill will take things. But I think the key thing for the manufacturers to be thinking about, and I think if we can get people as we're buying products to think about, these integrated batteries are really causing a big cost problem for recycling. And that's why CalRecycle is looking at increasing recycling fees across the board. They're saying anything that has a power cord probably should be considered as electronics and go to an electronics recycler. So they're forecasting the volume of electronics that come into their facilities growing and growing and growing. But intriguingly, you have something like an Apple Pencil. A lot of times the average weight of these devices goes down. So there's not a whole lot of raw material in this for the recyclers to make money, but they have to cut it open and remove the battery carefully.
Mm. Is your Apple Pencil broken? And did you try to fix it?
So Apple Pencil got a 0 out of 10 on a repair score. It's funny. It's the only product that Apple sells that comes with a replacement part because you can replace the tip if the tip breaks. But the rest of it, now it's completely monolithic. And unfortunately, there's no good way to separate it. So we're not sure that this is a very recyclable product either, even if it goes to an electronics recycler. And that's increasingly the challenge. You glue products together. It's possible to make products that aren't recyclable and also are not legal to landfill. And I don't think we're doing a great job in the tech press of holding companies accountable to creating products. For example, the Apple AirPods, which are the hit of this year. Everybody loves them. They're selling tens of millions of them. The AirPods are not recyclable by any electronics recycler. They're not recyclable by a municipal recycler, and they're not legal to landfill. So put it in your drawer and keep it there forever.
Forever and ever and ever, and pretend that it's never going to go anywhere.
Just leave
else.
Them in your ears.
Yeah.
As an accessory.
Yeah, exactly.
Get used to wearing them all the time, even when the battery's dead. Every company, like I was saying before, every company, you know, the technology companies especially, they have their secret sauce and they want that to stay secret. You mentioned on your site, ifixit.org/write, that proprietary codes are often used to kind of protect these things so that official people can fix it and no one else can, which, I mean, I can understand that a business wants to keep hold of its secrets, right? So there is that side, but you still want people to have the ability to fix and stuff on their own. How do you strike a balance between those things? Because they seem like competing forces.
Right. Yeah, this is a major problem for farmers right now because the tractors, like you'll have a big $250,000 John Deere tractor, and it's actually got a touchscreen interface in it. And if it has an error code that comes up, it'll say it's error P157. And they don't give the farmers the list of those error codes. So you have to pay the John Deere dealer to come out, plug his laptop into the tractor and tell you, hey, this particular sensor is broken. Ugh. So that's a major challenge for farm equipment. We're seeing that problem increasingly with cars. Independent repair shops are having a hard time working on Teslas because Tesla hasn't agreed to share the kinds of information with repair shops that every other car manufacturer is sharing. We see this with Nikon. Nikon used to make service information and tooling available to local camera shops, and a few years ago they stopped doing that. So systematically, manufacturers are trying to take control away from their customers, away from the rest of us, and away from local repair shops. And that's what the Right to Repair fight is all about, is trying to restore those rights.
So Assemblywoman Susan Eggman, she introduced the Right to Repair back in March. What is going on with it, and who supports it, and who doesn't support it?
Yeah, Right to Repair legislation has been considered in 19 states across the U.S. this year. It's also being considered around the world. We've got folks in Europe and Canada that are thinking about it. The California bill was introduced, and it was going to be heard in the Environment Committee. Some lobbyists pulled some dirty tricks and got it moved to another committee, and Eggman pulled the bill. So the California bill is dead for this year. It may come up again next year. Generally, there are not individual legislators that are opposed to it, but the primary organization fighting the right to repair laws is Apple. They are spending the most money. They're getting other organizations to represent them, but they're showing up. They told legislators in Nebraska that if Nebraska passed right to repair, it would turn Nebraska into a mecca for hackers. So we're seeing this grandiose fear, uncertainty, doubt on part of these corporate lobbyists, and we're fighting back with common sense as best as we can, but there's a lot more of them than there are us.
So someone in the chat room, Caillou, made a comment that I think is actually pretty important to this. He says, he or she says, actually, I don't know. So everyone here agrees to recycle responsibly. But sadly, the people that don't know or don't care far outnumber those of us who do and just dump everything in the trash. Is that one of the bigger challenges that we face in this regard when it comes to e-waste around the world, that this kind of complacency that, well, it doesn't affect me when I put it in the trash and I just move on with my life?
Yeah, absolutely. The amount of raw material that goes into manufacturing these things is huge. It takes 500 pounds of raw material to make an iPhone. And then even when we recycle it, we can't get all the material back, but we can at least get some of it. So I think that's just a message that we have to get out there, is that it is a huge investment of resources, of material, of labor to make the things that we have. We should take really good care of them, use them for as long as we possibly can, and then you know, as a last resort, get the most possible material back out of it. But that's something we have to be telling everybody. We have to really think through what is the impact of our consumption on the planet. If everyone in the world consumed at the rate that Americans do, we would need 13 Earths worth of resources. It just doesn't work. And at the same time, you're actually kind of sitting on a gold mine. A cell phone like this has 14 times as much gold in it as that amount of gold ore that you would mine out of the ground. So it's worth it. It's worth it to recycle these things and get the material out. Recyclers will pay for it. So I think we have to get people to kind of hopefully act in their own self-interest. Usually recycling or even selling something is in your best interest. I always tell people that the most environmentally friendly thing that you can do with all your stuff is to sell it, is to give it to somebody else, keep it out there, keep it used. Hopefully, if you sell your last cell phone to somebody, then that they'll use that instead of going and buying a new one.
Maybe worst case scenario is that we just take all the e-waste that we have, we attach it to a rocket, and we shoot it towards the sun.
Yeah, let's not do
that.
There
you go.
Okay. No, I totally believe that. I believe that with all my stuff. Like, I have just started selling, like, my clothes because at least you know someone is going to want it because... Yeah. You know, rather than just giving it to Goodwill, it ends up in landfills. I think the same as technology. It takes some time, and it kind of, you know, you're not going to like make a living off of selling this stuff or anything, but you're totally right. Like that someone will, if someone is willing to buy it, then they might buy it used. That's better than buying it new.
Right. Are you using Poshmark?
I am using Poshmark.
And how's it going?
It's going great. Do you use it to sell technology or just clothes?
Just close, and I use it to kind of check on, you know, you're like, hey, how much is my closet worth? Let's go find out.
It's weirdly addicting, isn't it?
Yeah, Poshmark is awesome.
You guys obviously know a secret. Meanwhile, I'm over here Googling Poshmark. Are you?
But I have seen like Apple Watches. I've seen Apple Watch bands on there and like cases and stuff. I haven't bought any, but there is
like
some.
If you want like a, if you have an old Patagonia jacket, you can get over $100 for it on Poshmark.
Mm-hmm. Dang. Yeah, I just like the idea that someone, you know, is going to use it if they're, you know, putting money, even if it's like $7 for something that you might have paid $150 for. You just think, well,
somebody's going to use it.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, as long as someone's paying for it, it's going to get used.
Yeah.
Well, Kyle, thank you as always for sharing your our shared Poshmark addiction, and but especially for your fighting for the right to repair and all your work that you do at iFixit. Kyle, of course, is a repair activist, right to repair activist, and the founder of iFixit. Go check it out. Check out all their videos of tearing Apple's products apart. It's very soothing, even if you never intend to fix your stuff, which you should.
Absolutely.
Or sell it.
Well, thank you. And thanks to all the hardworking folks at CalRecycle who worked for a couple of years putting this report together. It's really exciting to see the hard work of our civil servants.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kyle. We'll talk to you soon.
Cheers.
All right, up next, we explore the world of online therapy. But first, we're going to take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode, and that is Eero, actually. With Eero, You can install an enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system in your home in just a matter of minutes. You simply download the Eero app on your iOS or Android device, and it's going to walk you through each step of the process. It's super quick, easy. It's actually painless. You can create and share a guest network in your home, know how many devices are connected at any given point. You can check the internet speed that you're getting from your service provider. Eero is protected with state-of-the-art WPA2 encryption. Second generation Eero and Eero Beacon provide even more support here. Eero home Wi-Fi system started in early 2016. And since then, they've learned from hundreds of thousands of systems, making them smarter, faster, more reliable. The Eero second generation and Eero Beacon allow a customer to build a Wi-Fi system that's more perfectly tailored to their home than ever before. They offer more speed, more range, and the same high quality, elegant design that people have come to expect. And then, of course, the addition of a third 5 gigahertz radio in the second generation Eero. It's now tri-band. It's twice as fast as its predecessor, which lets customers do more at the same time in every room of their home. And with the addition of a new Thread radio, Eero can connect to low power devices such as locks, doorbells, other sensors, and a whole lot more. So you can expand your coverage in any room, and you can do it very easily also with the Eero Beacon. You simply plug it into a wall, and that's it. You're covered. It extends your Wi-Fi through that. You can add as many Eero Beacons as you want. If there's an outlet, there's Wi-Fi. For free overnight shipping to the U.S. or Canada, visit Eero.com, and at checkout, select overnight shipping. Then make sure to enter TNW to make it free. That's Eero.com. Make sure to enter code TNW, and we thank Eero for their support of Tech News Weekly. We're accustomed to doing so many things on the internet nowadays. There was a time not really that long ago when buying a last-minute gift or sending a handwritten letter or even finding a partner were things that happened in person, and doing so outside of that social norm was seen as strange, could be dangerous, even ineffective. But times have definitely changed, norms have shifted, and now it's possible to get some of the most important and impactful support in our lives online. And joining us is Susanna Weiss, a writer for Tonic, who wrote a piece about the growing field of online therapy. Welcome to the show, Susanna.
Hi.
It's great to have you here. Thank you for joining us tonight. So first things first, what kinds of therapy are we talking about here? And is it something as simple as like hopping onto FaceTime or Hangouts, or more structured than that?
That can range from an app like BetterHelp or Talkspace, where you could do it over chat, or there's a plan where you could do it over video. It could also just be a regular therapist who does some of their sessions over the phone or Zoom or Skype. It can be a whole range of things.
Sure. And I'm sure different therapists probably have their platform or their service of choice that they offer. Who are the ones who are open to remote therapy as an alternative to in-person visits? Like who is that working for versus others? I'm sure there are therapists out there that aren't open to this idea, but some of them are. Why the shift?
Well, there seem to be some therapists who do things mostly online, and then there seem to be some who maybe they have clients who have moved and they still want to see them, so they do it remotely. Or they've realized that a lot of people now do therapy remotely, so they've opened up their practice. I think it's just shifted because now we have more options. And why not if they can get more clients that way?
Mm-hmm. I know you dug into some of the research. So what does that say about the effectiveness? Is it equally effective to see a therapist on FaceTime or even through a text or a tool that you can text back and forth therapy than it is in person?
Yeah, most of the research seems to show that it is pretty equivalent. There was one study that found that people rated online therapy, they were as satisfied with it, but they rated it lower on satisfaction regarding feeling supported and encouraged. So that's one thing that some therapists talked about, that it was slower to develop an emotional connection with the patient if they weren't meeting in person. So it seems to be almost equivalent, but there might be some disadvantages.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you get the nonverbal cues if you're still doing a video message, but there's some intangible something that is probably missing, you know, versus someone sitting right in front of you versus on a screen, which we also associate with other things, right? Like the screen can mean that we're watching a movie or that we're doing all these other things with it. So maybe our mind interprets that differently in that regard. How do traditional therapists feel? Like that there must be some sort of a fracture line between those who are open and willing to do this and the steadfast, like lifelong in-person therapists that say, you know, there's just no way. Does that exist?
Well, I reached out to a number of therapists and I didn't have anybody say they will never do this. Some said they'll only do it if they have met the person in person before, because then they've already formed a connection with them. But most said that they would be open to it. So it seems like most therapists are at least open to the possibility, though some are more open to it than others. Mm-hmm. Some believe it's basically equivalent, while others think it's just something to do if you can't meet in person for logistical reasons.
Sure.
What about privacy issues? I mean, I've looked into some of these apps and, you know, it just seems like they promise privacy, but we've heard that before from many people. Like, is there anyone that's concerned about, you know, transcripts getting leaked or anything like that?
I haven't heard of anybody like specifically experiencing a leak, but if someone's concerned about that, then that might be a factor.
It's certainly in this day and age, it's certainly something to consider no matter what we're doing online. And then you think about the vulnerability, you know, that you potentially put yourself in, you know, in a live video call with someone where you're basically spilling your deepest, you know, thoughts and stuff like that. You could at least have some sort of concern about what could possibly go wrong.
Well, because there could be someone else in the room. You don't really
that's
know
true.
Necessarily.
Yeah. Somebody on the other side of the door, I suppose. Yeah, there's always that risk. What are the benefits of something like this? And are there recipients who prefer to do it this way for any number of reasons? Like those that choose to do this, like why do they choose to do it?
Well, one of the main benefits is that if you can talk to people who aren't in your immediate vicinity, then you have more options. So one person I interviewed talked about encountering a lot of therapists who said homophobic or victim blaming things. And once she found somebody who was LGBT friendly and didn't say victim blaming things, then she wanted to stick with her. I personally talked to a therapist remotely just because I met somebody I trusted. And to me, like, that connection is rare, and I don't want to risk like looking for somebody new and then them potentially saying things that make things worse.
Yeah.
Then another advantage is some people with mental health issues have a hard time leaving the house, or some people just don't want to leave the house. They don't have the time, or they have families to take care of. So it provides a more convenient option where they may not otherwise go to therapy.
What about cost? Is it significantly cheaper to see a therapist online rather than in person?
I'm guessing that would depend on a lot of things like insurance. I know some therapists, they'll probably charge the same. For things like Talkspace, I think their plans are pretty cheap. I remember one of their plans being around $40 a month. So it might be a cheaper option, but you also might not actually get to chat with someone. They do it sometimes totally over text and email, which is very different from phone or Skype.
Interesting. One place that my mind goes right now is that you know, right now the fact that we can even talk about this being an option, whereas 10, 15 years ago, it would have seemed, you know, kind of ludicrous to think about this. Now it's totally possible. Makes me think about where this is headed. Could technologies that we're seeing developing right now, VR is one example. Like, could these potentially, just in your opinion, be potential advantages, you know, down the line, or just distractions? Like, it also might seem kind of weird to have a therapy session with a big VR goggle strapped to your head, but maybe there are benefits there that I don't know of. What do you think?
I guess if somebody is concerned about the advantages of being in the same room as someone, like the emotional connection or the ability to read body language, then VR might offer an advantage. I'm not sure if it would offer much more than video.
Yeah, it'd probably be about the same. Susanna Weiss, we really appreciate you taking time to talk to us about this. Where can people go to follow all of your work online?
They could go to my Twitter. My name's Susanna Weiss.
Awesome. And read your work there as well. I know on Motherboard, Vice, Tonic, you're all over the place. So we appreciate you taking time to talk to us about it. Thank you, Susanna.
Thank you.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
I would like to go to therapy where, like, it was an animated character that was the therapist, like perhaps a friendly looking dog or
like a theremoji.
Yeah.
Something yes. like that.
Yeah. I like it.
Okay.
After the break, Juan D. Guevara Torres from Univision is here to talk about Facebook's issues in Latin America. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. When it comes to marketing your business, it's all about connecting with the right audience when your message will resonate the most. If you want to target your customers where they are every day and when they're ready to make a decision, LinkedIn can help you there. When you advertise on LinkedIn, the world's largest professional network, you have the opportunity to build long-term relationships with your customers, relationships that often translate into high-quality leads, website traffic, and higher brand awareness. The first step is always, always talking to the right audience. And every day, you might not know this, but over 500 million professionals, they go to LinkedIn, they engage with the content, and chances are your future customers are among them. LinkedIn has the marketing tools to help you target customers with precision down to their job title, the company name, and the industry. Better targeting, of course, equals a message that your customers will care about, which in turn leads to more trust built with your customers. In fact, 4 out of 5 customers on LinkedIn are decision makers at their companies, so you're building relationships that really, really matter. Promote your business with LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. To redeem a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit, just go to linkedin.com/TNW. That's linkedin.com/TNW, stands for Tech News Weekly, so they know that you were sent there by us. LinkedIn.com/TNW for your free $100 ad credit. Terms and conditions apply. Facebook's Cambridge Analytica scandal is not limited to the U.S. and the European Union. Joining us to talk about the problems Facebook and other social media that is creating in Latin America is Juan Guevara Torres from Univision. Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. So first, explain what kind of problems Facebook's misuse of customer data, what are the problems that that's specifically creating in Latin America?
Well, I'll tell you this. The problem is we know already that Facebook has been sharing data not only in Latin America, but everywhere. We just learned about that in China, and that continues to happen. Now, Latin America is extremely sensitive about privacy, and there is one reason, security. So when you have a company as Facebook sharing information about what's going on, and the Latin American market is extremely sensitive because of security, because there is kidnappings, because there is a problem when you post things on Facebook that they're replicated and the bad guys look at it, there's definitely a problem. Now, in this case, we know already the relationship between the U.S. and Latin America is not the best right now. So when we have people actually being accessed their information and being used for these type of purposes, like political purposes, is really bad. And the perception in Latin America about Facebook and what happened, it's not the best. In fact, I believe it's hurting them very, very, very badly. We have reports that Facebook is actually losing users in Latin America. They are starting to question using WhatsApp as a platform when they were using that platform to communicate with the family in the United States or in other countries in Latin America. people are stopping the use of Messenger, for example, and that's bad for Facebook because Facebook wanted to expand Latin America. They've been using Facebook to put the government, I guess, in check, because social media was a very powerful tool to make sure that democracy was going on, and all this that is happening is backfiring on them pretty badly.
So when you look at what like Mark Zuckerberg is doing, and you know, when he speaks to Congress, do you feel like he and the other people that at Facebook like have an idea, like a global understanding of these specific needs and situations in Latin America?
I really don't think so. I think Facebook is trying to appear local in different markets. They're trying to be local and be global at the same time, and that's not working in Latin America at all. What I see happening is the perception of Mark Zuckerberg in Latin America is, well, this is the guy that is selling our information, our pictures, our videos, the pictures of our kids to other companies for advertisement. I also believe that what is happening is essentially people are looking for other choices. There is no other social network as Facebook. I mean, there were some other intents in Latin America, but we are looking at people trying to build another social network besides Facebook in these countries. We've seen that actually in Russia, like there are other social networks. And there are developers in Latin America looking for an option right now to build a new social network that is an alternative to Facebook. That's why, for example, Instagram, which also it's a Facebook product, it's becoming more popular because, you know, it's very limited what you share there. I mean, you have pictures, either you like them or not. You can kind of follow your friends there as a social network. But we have to understand Facebook was used in Latin America for communication purposes with their families. In Latin America, the family is what actually built a society. In the U.S., it's the individual. In Latin America, it's actually the families. So when you're attacking the privacy of the families, it's not perceived well.
Interesting. I'm curious about the General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR. You know, we've heard about this especially intensely the last couple of weeks over in the EU. I'm curious to know how this could influence or affect some of these Latin American countries, you know, influence legislation in those countries specifically. Do you have an idea of what's going on in that regard?
Well, actually, yes. There were some different movements in Latin America. For example, one in Mexico where people actually used Twitter to put the government in check. There was a tax reform that was going on in Mexico right now. And then we'll talk about the elections in a second in Latin America that is happening right now. But there was a tax issue that the government wanted to push forward a few years back. And what happened was people went out on social media, Twitter. They use Facebook, but they mainly use Twitter. And the government needed to actually back out of the legislation that they wanted to do. So that was a big deal. Now, right now, the elections in Mexico, for example, that are going to happen in the next 2 weeks, are being run on social media. Because the media in Latin America is questioned in terms of the freedom that the media has in Latin America is non-existent. The way the system works is that media, television, radio, newspapers are controlled by the government in some sort. And the way they control the media in Latin America is by budgets. Either you're a good media to us, we give you more advertisement. You're not a good media to us, we don't give you anything. So what is happening right now is the candidates and people talking about all this stuff are going to social media to actually express, put platforms online, all that to be able to express their political views. Now, in terms of what we've seen in regards to the new data regulations that are going on, we will see Latin America actually mimicking what happened in the EU just, you know, a few years back. In fact, right now, The Facebook is being challenged by the Mexican government, for example, to put data centers in Mexico that are controlled by the Mexican law, not necessarily in the US, because what is happening right now is if you want to access Facebook, well, your data is in the US, so Mexico doesn't have any jurisdiction. So what Mexico is pushing, for example, right now is to have data centers in Facebook in Mexico that are controlled by Mexican jurisdiction. And that's happening also, for example, in Venezuela. Venezuela obviously has a lot of problems in terms of what's going on in there, what's actually happening with the political views there. And Venezuela is also pushing Facebook to either put data centers that can be controlled by the Venezuelan government, or they're starting to block Facebook. We've seen that in the past. I mean, you have to use a VPN software to be able to bypass the blockage that is happening in Venezuela right now to be able to access Facebook. So we're looking at government, we're looking at society reacting very harshly on what we've learned on Facebook in the past year, I guess. And we're going to see repercussions on that very quickly.
So moving on, I know you attended WWDC out here in California this week. What was the highlight for you?
Well, you know, I was impressed by the age of the developers. I can tell you that. I am 43 years old. I wish I learned code Swift, I guess, when I was 6 or 7 or 12. But we'll see these young kids now making a lot of money in developing apps. And that's what really, you know, impressed me. Every time we'll see developers that are younger, brighter. That's number one, and I love that because I think I with Apple in this regard is I would hope that every kid knows how to code. That's number one. Number two, I actually believe that in this time the iOS 12 actually became, or I guess the standard was better. I see an operating system that actually it's better than what we had before. I think Apple was lagging in a lot of ways with the macOS and with the iOS 12. And I think finally we're looking at the Apple being Apple and being kind of catching up to Samsung and Android because, for example, I truly believe the Galaxy S9 is a better phone than the iPhone X. And we were lagging in the Apple ecosystem as an iOS that actually works and explodes everything that the hardware does. But I can tell you, it was good in terms of a launch. It was good in anything that we have experienced. I think it was a good conference in terms of what it was announced. I was expecting some hardware. I was expecting a refresh of some of the MacBooks. Actually, we were expecting a little bit more, better software for the hardware for the watch. But I think they did good. And one of the things that actually got my attention is the fact that they recognize that Siri is not all there. I think Alexa is better. I think Google Home is way better in terms of how it interacts with the user. And I think finally Apple is starting to realize that Siri needed a major revamp.
Man, if Apple's only just now realizing this we've got a problem. This has been a problem for so long now. So I have a question, and I'm curious to hear your take on it. One of the things from the WWDC event was a new feature called Screen Time. And, yes. You know, we've it's basically set to kind of like help a user curb their smartphone usage, addiction, whatever right. You want to call it. Google has something similar coming up in Android P. I'm curious to know, is this... I mean, from your perspective, like being so in tune with like Latin American markets, let's say, yeah. Are features like this, from your perspective, aimed more at the American market and American users? In other words, are we the ones that are so obsessed with our technology, or is this pretty much standard across the board? Do you see this in Latin American countries as well?
Most definitely. I believe that there are some countries in Latin America that believe that the iPhone is an addictive device. So I actually believe it was a very good idea on providing that data, screen time to the parents to say, hey, this is what's happening with your kid's device. And we're going to provide you with tools how to you can restrict or limit their use with your kids. I can tell you, I have two daughters, and well, now we live in the U.S. They were born here and everything. But I can tell you that they're addicted to Minecraft. They love YouTube. They don't watch TV. They want to see these games.
Yep.
And as a parent, it's an important tool to be able to tell them, hey, we love technology. Obviously, I love tech. That's what I do for a living. But at the same time, we need to make sure that there are limits on how they actually access these devices. So screen time was actually one of the two things. There was another one, but two things that actually the Latin American love to be able to monitor what the kids do with their devices. And the other thing that they loved and they're waiting to get their hands on is multiple FaceTime. FaceTime with up to 32 people. That was something that was very important, because you have to understand, we have people moving into, well, not as much anymore, but we were used to have people moving into the U.S., leaving their countries and leaving their families behind. And no one spends in long international long distance anymore. I mean, I remember the cards that you needed to prepay, cell phones and everything. Now it's either WhatsApp, FaceTime, Skype. And the fact that now I can have my family together in a Skype and a FaceTime conversation all together, it was very well received. I think that's going to have a major impact in the way Latin America adopt the iOS 12. I think it's going to push a lot of people to buy iOS devices, because you have to understand, Mexico is big in Huawei. It's big in Android. Not as much as iOS, because the iOS devices are very expensive for someone that is earning in pesos and spending in dollars. So Android had cheap phones in Mexico. The same thing in Latin America. Huawei is actually busting the market there, or getting the market there, because they're cheaper devices. Now that you have a different approach to iOS, people are willing, I believe, to spend the extra amount of dollars to get a feature as FaceTime for multiple people.
Well, Juan, thank you so much for joining us. Juan Guevara-Torres is a tech expert at Univision. I wanted to watch all your videos that are all up on YouTube, and it was one of those times where I should have learned Spanish because they're all in Spanish. It's not too late for me. As soon as I'll watch them to help me with my Spanish. And Juan can also be found on Twitter at JuanTechTV. Thank you so much for coming on.
I enjoyed it, guys. I hope I can be on sometime soon. And we'll talk to you guys later.
All right.
We love your perspective. Thank you, Juan.
So now you can breathe a sigh of relief, because Target, Walmart, Amazon, and eBay have all pulled the hackable teddy bears called Cloud Pets, pulled them from their shelves. Now, Cloud Pets are a line of smart toys. They store email addresses, passwords, and the voice recordings of children. They stored them so insecurely that hackers were able to access them and then proceeded to hold the information for ransom. This happened at least twice. The breach affected more than 800,000 people. It was first reported in February of 2017, but the toys were all still being sold until this week.
Yeah, talk about like taking time to get around to this. So Mozilla was the company that was kind of beating the drum on these Bluetooth vulnerabilities, pointing out that they're still there. And basically this is being pulled because Mozilla pressed the issue so much. The Mozilla VP of Advocacy, Ashley Boyd, said, "The vulnerability has been clear for a while. There's been no action. Some smart toys are better at security than others, but we felt like Cloud Pets was an egregious example. Our goal was to reach out to retailers to make sure they knew exactly what kind of product they were selling." And apparently, the manufacturer of the toys never responded to all of these emails from, you know, people, you know, responsible disclosure, all this kind of stuff. You never got a response. So it was obvious they didn't care. Completely irresponsible. So, you know, and it really ties into something that we've definitely been talking about a lot, which is the security practices of IoT devices and like how much do they care? It's, you know, A, they're not building these devices with security in mind, but B, once something is discovered after the fact, do they care to do anything about it? And something like this is just kind of crazy. It took this long.
And it also makes me wonder, what are they going to do with all those toys that they pulled off the shelf? Like, are they going to end up right in the landfill? And right. If not, are they going to be on some market where, like, someone else will use them and they'll still be insecure? And yeah, so
I guess there's still stuffed animals. You could just tear out the electronics and patch them up again.
Just
and
slice them open.
Yeah. Well, if there's electronics inside, then there's a battery inside. So there's some way to open it up and remove it to replace the battery. So just cut that out of there and here you go. It's a stuffed animal.
Yeah, just a little stuffed animal surgery.
A hollow stuffed animal.
Yeah. That you'll have to imagine them talking back to you. I think like just the idea, just the name, like cloud pets, like that just sounds ominous. Your child's, you know, childhood. It's in the cloud.
It seemed like a good idea at the time.
I don't think it never seemed like a good idea to me, but yeah.
Did to somebody. They probably made a good amount of money before they finally got shut down. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can always be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
Subscribe to our show. You can do that at twit.tv/tnw. Also, you can subscribe in whatever tool you use. You can listen, watch, whatever device. We don't care where you listen, just that you listen or watch. And you can tweet at me. I am Megan Maroney on Twitter.
And I'm Jason Howell on Twitter. And thanks to our technical director, Josh. Appreciate it. Thanks to Jammer Beath, Burke, Colleen, everybody here who helps us with the show each and every week. And we will see you next time. Thanks to you for watching another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.